Okay, everybody. This is Mark Schenker welcoming you to the SOAP Clinical Teleconference. And today we've got Dr. Brandon Bergman presenting on recovery-related use of social media. And Dr. Bergman is Associate Director and the Research Scientist at the Research Recovery Institute of Mass General Hospital. He's an instructor at Harvard Medical School, and he's a licensed clinical psychologist. His PhD is from Nova Southeastern University, and he did his internship and postdoc at MGH and Harvard Medical School. And, you know, if you have a minute at some point, Brandon, I would be happy to hear a little more of what you do in the Recovery Research Institute. My usual words of advice is please respect confidentiality if you bring up any clinical material because we are being recorded. Please, please press your mute buttons. I said it right that time. And we have calls coming up. We're scheduled through September. What's happening in May is a little up in the air, but I'll be letting you all know if you're on the distribution list. And a lot of the past calls are on the website, addictionpsychology.com, and sooner or later this one will be too. So with no further ado, Dr. Bergman, you're on.
Great. Thanks, thanks, Mark. I really appreciate it. So what I figure is, appreciate the introduction, but I figure I'll do is, so I'll go through my presentation here, and then I'll stop periodically to give you all a chance to ask questions or what have you. And then if there's any time at the end, hopefully there is, we can talk a little bit about the Recovery Research Institute and the kinds of things that we're doing here at in Boston. So, and then the other, just real quick, piece of the introduction is that I know that Mark sent out slides for everybody related to the presentation, and it's a little bit different, obviously, since I'm not giving a presentation in person. So what I'll do is I'll kind of let you know, if it's what slide I'm on. I might skip, because there are probably more slides than we have time to review, and I'll skip things that I don't think are quite as relevant or don't need as much time. So I'll just say, like, you know, please skip ahead to the fifth slide or the seventh slide or whatever. So I'll just give you guys that heads up. So, so let's get started. And if you go to the second slide, here are my disclosures. I can answer any questions about those. And then let's go to the third slide here. There are three main points that set up this entire talk. And as a kind of a caveat here, as the title might suggest, we have certainly a paucity of data when it comes to how we can use social media, and I'll usually call them social network sites, to help enhance treatment and recovery. And so the studies that I'm going to present, three different studies that I've conducted, and that we've conducted here at the Recovery Research Institute. And in a lot of ways, these three studies are what I hope will help set the table for a line of research into how to use social network sites to enhance and understand substance use disorder treatment and recovery. So in a lot of ways, and you'll notice this, the data will probably bring up more questions than answers for you at this point in time, and that's okay. That's the way the presentation is designed, and at the very end of the presentation, I'll talk about some of the questions that have come up for me as I'm doing some of these studies and how that can inform future research and clinical work in the area. All right, so we're on the third slide here, and essentially what these graphs show is that there is roughly only 10% of people, of U.S. adults, with a substance disorder that are going to seek any kind of treatment or recovery support service or any kind of service whatsoever for their substance use problem. Now, we talk a lot about, right, healthcare access, which is an important piece of the discussion. At the same time, when you ask, if this is all from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, when you ask these 90% of U.S. adults who didn't seek treatment but had a substance disorder why they didn't, 95% of them say they didn't think they needed treatment. There are a few different ways to think about that, right? I think some part of the conversation is, well, we need to do a better job helping people get into treatment. So I think that's a piece of this. For me, a very big part of the conversation is also around how we define treatment, especially in the U.S. And typically treatment for substance disorders is something that's a big deal for people. They have to make a commitment, and typically they have to rearrange or sometimes upend their lives completely. And so what this suggests to me is a need to shift or to expand our understanding of what it means to seek help for alcohol and other drug use disorders in our in the country. So then, now if you go to the second big issue that even for people that do seek treatment, depending on how you define relapse, we'll just call it drinking or using any drugs. About 60% of people that seek treatment are going to drink or use other drugs in the post-treatment year. And then the third major piece or major kind of gap is that we in this country we have about 1.5 million adults. Probably more if you consider adolescents, but certainly 1.5 million of adults who are seeking substance use disorder services, even though they no longer meet criteria, right? So it's this idea of continuing care and the need to be involved in ongoing recovery support services to help maintain lower levels or lower relapse risk. So, and then all three of those needs, as you see in this bullet point, the need for increased access to recovery support and resources, especially for that 90% of people who aren't getting any services, the need to buffer against post-treatment relapse or continuing care, as it's often called, and the need to support individuals in a long-term recovery management framework. And what I'll put forward to you is I think that they can all be at least partially addressed by social network sites. And when we talk about these three needs, emerging adults, which are defined differently, but it's a particular area of interest of mine, you can call them young adults or what have you, they are empirically particularly challenging when it comes to these three needs in our treatment and recovery system. So now if you look at the fifth slide, when it comes to treatment and recovery, one social network is important. This we know this already. There's been a lot of great, great work that's been done empirically by folks to show that one's social network composition, so like, for example, the percent of heavy drinkers in their network, or on the flip side, the percent of abstainers or individuals in recovery that relates to substance disorder onset and offset. And then when we see people that do make changes, positive recovery-related changes, network changes are helping explain that benefit. They're mechanisms of behavior change. And also some qualitative data, for example, that by my colleague Allison Labby that we did here at the Recovery Research Institute also has shown that it's a lot of these group processes potentially that are helping explain benefit as well. When you look at sort of Yalom's curative factors in terms of how people make changes from a substance use disorder change perspective, a lot of the things they cite in terms of why going to mutual help organizations is helpful, it's these social pieces. It's that feeling of shared experience and cohesion, the installation of hope that they're getting from other people and giving back, providing service, right? So when we think about technology so far, and I'm on the sixth slide now, and the ways in which technology has been leveraged, and I'll stop in about a minute or two to see if anybody has questions so far. And the ways in which technology has been leveraged. And we talk about technology, and a few of us were talking about it on the call earlier. It's getting a lot more attention in kind of the public zeitgeist in a lot of ways right now, and you're reading it in every news magazine and online website and whatnot. So it's much more part of the public consciousness. At the same time, even if you just look at addiction treatment, folks have been using technology to help try to enhance addiction treatment and addiction treatment outcomes since the 90s, at least since the mid-90s. But where they started, and if you kind of look from top to bottom, it really started was using computer to help deliver empirically supported treatments. And then over time, those treatments have gotten more sophisticated so that they can adapt to individual factors and become tailored to individuals. And then if you look at the third row there, we're starting to be able to use technology to measure people's psychological, psychophysiological processes, feed those back to folks. And up until this point, though, for the most part, a clinician has been involved in the process. They've taken place only in the context of treatment. And so what we're really going to focus on in this presentation is the fourth row. That is ways in which technology is being used to connect individuals seeking recovery from substance disorder or in recovery, how that's being used to connect individuals to other individuals, maybe within treatment, but not necessarily. So then now if we look at the seventh slide, the argument I'll make to you today is that I think social network sites, and social media is another way of saying that, but I'll usually use the word social network sites, which is one kind of social media. And so to make sure that we're on the same page, when I'm talking about, when I use that terminology, social network sites, what I'm talking about are specific kinds of social media where an individual creates a profile, where when they connect to other people on the site, you can see who they're connected to, how they're connected, but certainly who they're connected to and traverse those connections. So I can see, for example, who Mark is connected to on Facebook, who his friends are, and then say, oh, I know so-and-so, and I'm going to friend request them, right, and to be able to traverse those connections, and then to be able to create and interact with user-generated, user-shared content. So these kinds of sites are like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, but not necessarily Snapchat, for those of you that know Snapchat, which is more of a messaging app. The distinctions are not that important, but what I'm talking about is fundamentally an online community of individuals that are interacting with each other and where you can see how who is interacting with whom and how they're interacting with each other. And when it comes to social network sites, we know they're popular among the U.S. general population. About 70% overall of U.S. adults are using social network sites, and when you look at 18 to 29-year-olds, that number jumps to 88%. And recently, folks have started to look at substance use disorder programs. And so the question is, of course, well, yes, they're popular in among U.S. general, you know, among U.S. adults, but does that translate also to addiction treatment settings? And the answer seems to be, at least so far, yes. So in a sample of outpatient adults in a substance use disorder program, for example, the Ashford et al. Study that I put up here, 70% were using social network sites. And then if you look at the table there on the bottom right-hand corner, you see that more than 70% of substance disorder treatment patients own a smartphone. Now, just a little bit of a teaser, if you look down further at the table and you see the contract type, about 50% or half are on a pay-as-you-go plan, which is a bit more of a precarious or sort of a tenuous use of the smartphone. So now before... Why don't I go over the eighth slide, because then that will set up the three talks, and then I can just pause for a second to see if anybody has questions. So you might be asking, what does the research show so far on social network sites and health behavior change? And this is where the title of the talk comes in, where there's a lot of theory and kind of common sense in some ways or intuition to suspect that we can use social network sites, given how ubiquitous they are and given how much they are part of our social ethos, that we can use them to help enhance health behavior change when it comes to addiction. But we really have very little data to be able to speak to that. So these bullets here talk about how social network sites are already being used to help with other kinds of health behavior change, like physical activity, weight loss. There's a really good study to show that it helps an online smoking cessation community was helpful in efforts to aid individual smoking cessation and their 30-day abstinence rates. When it comes to alcohol and other drug problems, the data are quite limited. They're not non-existent. We published some papers and some other really good important preliminary work here. And so what that's shown so far, and I'm looking at the third bullet here on the eighth slide and these sub-bullets. So what that's shown is the people that are using social network sites in these online communities to try to address their alcohol and other drug problems, they have a range of severity levels, so some mild problems, some moderate problems, some with more severe problems, a range of goals. So some had abstinence goals, some might have goals to limit their drinking or drink within lower risk drinking guidelines or what folks might call harm reduction. The levels of engagement are pretty modest. They're coming on, but then they might drop off, so we have a hard time kind of with keeping people engaged, and we're not exactly sure why. And so far, the data that's been examined has been on content analyses. So people are going on these sites, researchers, and really examining the posts that people are putting on these sites and how people are responding to those, but they're not really looking so far at the individuals themselves who are using it. So we don't have a great sense of who's participating on these sites, how do they derive benefit over time. I'm not necessarily going to be able to speak to how they derive benefit over time, but I'll get at that a little bit. And the last point to make is there's an emerging literature, particularly among college students, not necessarily college students with alcohol problems, but that show that there is a bit of a kind of social influence effect such that, and this is prospectively, such that when young people are participating on social network sites, they're likely to be exposed to content that is pro-alcohol, pro-marijuana, sometimes other drugs, but we don't know that much about those, and that kind of exposure seems to be predicting an increase in their drinking and other drug use over time. That being said, we have little to no understanding about how those kinds of things play out in clinical samples. So we know very little about young adults that are seeking treatment and that might have a substance disorder and how they're participating on social network sites and how that participation might be influencing their substance use. So now, if you go to the ninth slide, that lays out the objectives, but I think it's a good time to just pause for a second and see if anybody has questions. That's the end of the introduction, and I'm going to get into the studies themselves. Does anybody have any questions so far?
Hey, Brandon, I have a question about the 95% of people who don't feel they need treatment.
Yep.
What's the denominator there? What's the population that is saying that?
So that's among people, U.S. adults, so this is the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. It's people that, quote-unquote, had a need for substance disorder treatment. And so that included people with a diagnosed substance use disorder using the DSM-4, but people with a diagnosed substance disorder, as well as those who actually sought specialty treatment. So that's like 20 million people with a substance use disorder and an additional 1 or 1.5 million people who sought treatment but may have been in remission from a substance use disorder. So the denominator there is like 20 or 21.5 million people, U.S. adults, who, by SAMHSA's definition, had a need for specialty care.
So they all have – okay, got it.
So for the most part, they all had substance use disorder in the past year, for the most part.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. Any other questions? Okay, so why don't we move on then? And then as I talk about the different studies, other questions might come up. On the ninth slide, I lay out the objectives of this talk. And so as I mentioned, I'm going to talk about three studies, and those are the first three numbers there. I won't talk too much about the studies, but I'll talk about them as we go into them. And then I'll finish up the presentation with a discussion on kind of what are the implications what are the implications right now for clinical work? What's the research agenda? What do we need to learn more about in order to really understand how potentially we can use social network sites to truly help people in meaningful and lasting ways? So now if you go to the 10th slide, you'll see the title there. And now go to the 11th slide. And so for this study, the question we're going to ask, we're going to take a big picture look. And we're going to look to see across all U.S. adults, across all U.S. adults who had former substance problems, that is, they have resolved an alcohol or the drug problem. And I'm going to skip over quite a few of the methods for this study and give you guys a chance to ask questions if you have, just for the kind of sake of time. But the primary questions are, what is the prevalence of using online technologies, including social network sites, but not limited to those, and I'll talk about the definition, but how prevalent is using online technologies to cut down on substance use, abstain from substances, and to strengthen one's recovery? So in this study, I'll call that recovery-related use of online technology, and that the acronym here will be ROOT. So every time you see ROOT, that's what it means. And then to look at what factors are associated with that use of online technology. And so this is just naturalistic use of technology to aid one's efforts at making a change in their substance use. Next slide just shows an abstract. So all these data, they were a secondary analysis of of a Recovery Research Institute study called the National Recovery Study. That main paper from the National Recovery Study was published in Drug and Alcohol Dependence, and we've since published a few other papers from this data set. And I'm happy to send any PDFs. I can send PDFs out to Mark, and he can send them out to the group, or you can all get my email address. I'm happy to communicate with you, and I can send you PDFs of the study if you're interested in learning more about our findings here. If you go to the next slide, this reviews some of the method. The long and the short of it is This is a nationally representative sample of U.S. adults who identify, right, who self-report as, quote, unquote, that they used to have a problem with alcohol or drugs but no longer do. You see the sample size there, but again, it's representative of the U.S. population, and we use some fancy survey methodology and weights to be able to get at these data. So all of the results that you're seeing, we used weighting and specific kinds of statistical procedures to be able to get at estimates of the U.S. population. The only interesting thing here that I think is important to mention is that half were currently abstinent from all substances, the other half are using one or more substances, and half had some history of service utilization, which may be treatment, maybe mutual help organizations, maybe going to one's primary care physician to get help for their alcohol or drug problem, but the other half did not use any services whatsoever. If you go to the next slide, there's a little bit more about the method, and how we define online technologies is they either identified as having used online mutual help organizations, so like online AA or online NA, they identified using social network sites. So they could have identified using general interest sites, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or they might have identified what we call recovery-specific sites. And in the second study I mentioned, I'm going to talk about one recovery-specific site called intherooms.com. So these are sites, they look, smell, and feel a whole lot like the social network sites that we know and are part of the zeitgeist, like Facebook, but they cater to individuals that are in recovery from SUD or seeking recovery. And then the third one was a kind of non-social sources of online technology, which could have been smartphone apps, other online resources. And you see here the different factors that we took a look at. So these are the demographic factors that we looked to see if they predicted use of online technology. And then we did have a pretty decent sense about their clinical history and their clinical and other substance use history. So these are all the factors that we took a look at. Next slide just shows the statistical, kind of how we set up the statistical analyses, which I won't get into, but you can ask questions if you want. And now the next slide shows the results. So I'm on slide 16 here. And so what the findings showed was that 11% of U.S. adults, naturalistically, that resolved an alcohol or the drug problem, used online technology to aid their efforts either, again, in cutting down, abstaining from substances, or in strengthening their recovery. And what you see here are the different breakdowns. So 9% of them were using online mutual help organizations. Almost 7%, 6.8% were using social network sites of some kind. And then 5.6% were using another kind of online technology like smartphone apps. Again, just to reiterate, this is not 11% of the U.S. adult population that's using technology to help resolve their problem. This is 11% of those who resolve their problem. So the percent of U.S. adults that resolve their problem, that resolve the substance problem is actually 9.1% roughly. So if you think what it works out to is about 1% of people. So one out of every 10 U.S. adults that resolve the problem use online technologies, that amounts to about 1% of the U.S. population. So now if you go to the next slide, here are some demographics that predicted use of online technology. So who are the people that are naturalistically using these online technologies to help them? And some of these things kind of go in the expected direction. Other ones I think were pretty surprising to me, actually. So younger folks naturalistically are using online technology. I'll talk about that in a little bit. I think this has a little bit less to do with age and more to do with the availability of online technologies for folks who quit more recently. Interestingly, individuals with less education, so less than a high school diploma, compared to those with a high school diploma, they were more likely to use online technologies. Hispanic individuals more likely than white individuals. Individuals that had lower income, lower household income, those with less than $30,000 in household income, compared to $100,000, they were more likely. And then, not that surprising, those with household internet access. So now when it comes to clinical substance characteristics, if you look at the next slide, this controls for or accounts for all the demographics. And so this is over and above that. What we see, if you look at the graph on the left, what that tells us is that individuals who participated in drug court, so they were arrested and diverted through the drug court system, they were more likely to use online technology in their efforts to resolve their problem. And if you look at the graph on the right, again, over and above demographics, those who use some kind of medication, and those who use some kind of recovery support service, not including mutual health organizations and not including professional treatment. These are non-professional recovery support services. They were more likely. And then if you look at the bottom, you see some other correlates of having used online technologies. Okay, now if we go down with this quick summary. If we think about, 1% of people, at least that sounds pretty small, but that's 2.5 million adults that have a recovery-related use of online technology. And so if you think about the public health impact of any intervention, we're talking not only about how effective it is, but also about its reach. And so naturalistically, what these data show is that without really too many dissemination efforts, online technologies to help people with substance use problems or the use of those anyways, it has substantial reach. But we know very little about their effectiveness. We don't know if people are using technologies that have any empirical support for them. We also don't necessarily know in what ways they're using those technologies. We just know by their self-report that they're doing so. And so we certainly need to learn more about their effectiveness. And then when it comes to younger age, I just was curious, and I took a look after the fact at this effect at younger age as a predictor of online technology use. And what it's about is that younger individuals also appear to have more psychological distress currently, and also, as you might expect, they resolve their problem more recently. And so if somebody resolved their substance use problem more recently, they were going to have more access to online technologies and helping them do so, whereas if somebody resolved their problem 15, 20, 25 years ago, there wasn't that access to online technology to help them do so, right? So really what that younger age effect is about, I think, is about the ways in which younger people are kind of more immersed in technology because it's more a part of their day-to-day lives. And so I think for folks that are young now, but as they get older, they'll be just fine in terms of being able to use online technology. So it's a bit of a cohort effect. And the last thing to talk about before I pause for questions and move on to the second study is in terms of kind of challenges for consideration for folks who are in clinical settings and potentially also folks who are doing research in this area, is that the markers of what predicts online technology use, they look like greater levels of severity. So individuals who had more current psychological distress were using online technology. Individuals who were prescribed and taken a medication for their substance use problems were more likely. And those who use recovery supports or these kind of other non-mutual health recovery support services, these less popular, less accessible forms. And so what that speaks to for me is they have greater levels of severity, so they're probably more motivated, more willing to try lots of things, including but not limited to online technologies. And so because they have more severity, I think it's important that at least for now we pay attention to what might come along with that. And so they might have more cognitive difficulties. They might have difficulties maintaining effort at a task, and so they might need a bit more support. And so developers who are developing these technologies may wish to account for some of these difficulties in thinking and navigating a platform that might be related to psychological distress. And if you guys have patients that are using these technologies, it might help to think about some of these things. And the last thing is that, as I mentioned earlier in the talk in the introduction, when you look at those who are in substance disorder treatment, yes, 70% have a smartphone, but of those, half have pay-as-you-go plans. So their access to technology may be a bit more tenuous, right? So if let's say a patient starts to really find a smartphone application or a social network site helpful in their recovery efforts, but then they lose access to their primary way of accessing the Internet, that's a problem. And so there are different ways that we can think about that from a systemic perspective. One thing, as I'm thinking about, is that especially for those who are developing the technologies, develop it using multiple platforms, so not just smartphone applications, but also online and being able to use a computer so maybe they can go to the library and use technology, et cetera. That's sort of the end of the first study. Before I get to the second study, I want to pause there and see if anybody has questions about this study, about the methods, anything I can answer there. Okay, no questions. All right, So now let's talk about the second study. And so here we're going to be narrowing our focus a bit. So the first study was really a macro perspective on how those who resolve the problem are using online technology. In the second study, I'm going to talk about individuals that are using a recovery-specific social network site, one particular one in a survey that I did with them. And so if you go to the next slide, so we're on slide 21 here, you'll see the three research questions that I asked. And so the first question was, when we're looking at individuals that are participating on a recovery social network site, what does that participation look like? What resources are they using? What activities are they doing? Or engaging in, rather. And then this, sort of how often are they participating, for how long, how frequently. The second question is, to what extent do they perceive benefit? So we're not, it wasn't a longitudinal study. Again, some of these studies are going to bring up more questions than answers, but we did get a sense of how do they perceive benefit on recovery-related mechanisms of behavior change that we know do a good job at predicting outcomes, like how motivated are they for abstinence? Do they feel some self-efficacy or some sense of confidence to abstain? Do they experience any reduced craving? And how, what's their identity as a person in recovery like? And then the last piece is, for these two questions, are there differences for people that are earlier in their recovery or not in recovery at all, not abstinent at all, versus those who have a year or more? And I chose those distinctions to map on to the DSM criteria, or the DSM distinction of sustained remission, you know, with a year, full remission with a year or more. So if you go to the next slide, you see an abstract. These data were published in Psychology of Addictive Behavior. So you can, if you have questions about this, and you can go there for more information or a more detailed look at the study. And again, I'm happy to send this as a PDF to you guys if you want to take a look. If you go to the next slide, slide 23, you see two screenshots. And these are, I wanted to give you guys a sense of what In the Rooms, the site's called intherooms.com, and what it looks like. And these, the leadership sent these to me, and they de-identified it so that it's we're not breaching anybody's privacy here. Speaking of privacy issues, as we were talking about a little before the call. And within the rooms, it's available by web platform, so you can log on from a desktop or a laptop computer, or it's available by smartphone application, and those two are seamless, which is a nice piece of it. And the other thing, too, is if anybody is interested in kind of learning more about recovery social network sites, intherooms.com is not the only one, and I don't have any stake or particular I'm not tied to them in any sort of way, but I encourage you to check it out, and I could talk to you about some other ones, too. I encourage you to check it out because it's free. So you just go on, you give a username and an email address, you create a username and password, and then you can go on and explore and sort of see what it's like and get a sense for what it feels like. And so if you go to the next slide, it's a little bit about the method. I'm going to skip over this a little bit. The only thing to mention is that when I compared those with less than a year to those with a year or more, we're talking about 123 people overall, 42 of which, so about a third, had less than a year abstinent or were not abstinent at all. You go to the next slide, a little bit more about the method. So this is just a bit about who the sample is and their primary substance. They had a lot of them, about 80%, had a history of treatment or other kinds of recovery support activities, like mutual help meetings. 90% of these folks had, because these were people that were participating in recovery social network site, it makes sense that they would be have kind of higher levels of technology engagement. So 90% of them had smartphones, and 70% of them were using other kinds of social network sites on a daily basis, like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, mostly Facebook. So now let's look at the findings. If you go to the next slide, and you see these graphs at the top. So and these are frequencies, or sort of how often people are participating on the site, and then the times they do. If you look at the pie chart on the right hand side, so that speaks to the times they do log in or the times they are on the site, for about how long are they spending time on the site. And so the average or modal user, I think it was the average actually, the average user in this particular survey was participating on In the Rooms for several times a week, and when they logged on, they did so for about 30 minutes at a time. Those rates of usage were similar for those with less than a year or more than a year. If anything, it kind of favored, even though it wasn't significant, it did favor those with less than a year, which sort of makes sense. If you have less time in recovery, you might be more engaged in a site that's meant to help aid recovery, right? Because you feel like you need that support. And then the last point is that only about a third were participating on In the Rooms using their smartphone app. So about two-thirds were doing so less than half the time or not at all. But if you look at the next slide, what this shows is the activities that people were participating in. So one thing that's really interesting about intherooms.com is, and again, if this is the kind of thing that's interesting to you, I encourage you to go explore the site yourself. And so it has, yes, it looks and feels and smells like a social network site like Facebook, and it's very clear how it's trying to cater or intending to cater to folks that are in recovery from substance problems or want to be in recovery. So there are recovery-related resources all over the site. First of all, there are discussion boards that are focused on recovery. There's a database that's updated ongoing to help people find face-to-face mutual help and other 12-step and other mutual help meetings. There's a speaker tape database so that AA speakers and NA speakers that are at conventions and things like that that are sharing their experience rates, and hope you can listen to those tapes. And then there's daily meditations. Then sort of most importantly, this is the part of the site that they put front and center, is they have live online video mutual help meetings. Most of them are 12-step meetings, and you'll see there's definitely a 12-step orientation to the site. At the same time, there are meetings that are not necessarily 12-step that are more for particular populations, so for women or veterans or individuals with a history of trauma. And then most recently I saw, I talked to the CEO and COO, and they're trying to kind of broaden the scope of their meetings. They just got a smart meeting on there, which is, for those who don't know, the secular mutual help organization that's fairly popular, but about which we know fairly little empirically. There's a really interesting study that was just published by Sarah Zemore and her colleagues, but that's a separate issue. So these are just the rates of use for the different activities that people are involved in. If you look at the next slide, so it's on slide 28, this is perceived benefit among those who are using the site. And this is level of agreement. This was we looked at this perceived benefit in a fairly straightforward / crude way, where we asked them, when it comes to your participation on In the Rooms, on intherooms.com, to what extent do you feel like your participation helps for motivation, helps increase your motivation for abstinence, right? Intherooms.com helps increase my motivation for abstinence. One, completely disagree. Six, completely agree. So what you see is, if you think about 3.5 as the midpoint, you see people generally agree that they find their social network site participation helpful, and that those levels, although it wasn't overwhelming necessarily, right? It wasn't like in the fives. It was a little over four. But that was similar for those with less than a year in recovery and those with a year plus, and a little bit less so for craving and identity as a person in recovery. If you look at the last slide, these are just sort of some of the summary and implications of the findings. As a reminder, this was a cross-sectional survey, so it's not that we certainly cannot say that individuals who are participating in intherooms.com are deriving benefit from doing so. And so to me, what this says is that they perceive benefits, so it warrants longitudinal investigation. I'm especially interested, even though the context of a lot of my work to date and a lot of my initial early career plans are to look at this in clinical populations, I'm really interested in how those who use these sites are doing so outside of treatment settings, what I sometimes call self-management. At the same time, I'm interested in how it could be used in clinical settings, right? How could it be used during treatment to help folks get exposure to an online recovery supportive network potentially, and then as a continuing care intervention? Then there are all sorts of really interesting questions. So like, if it is shown to be helpful, how, why, what is it about recovery social networks and participation that explains benefit? Is it the activities that's there? Is it the social support that the 24/7 access to social support that they're able to get? Is it none of the above, right? So is it just that being in a community, even in an online community, that's increasing their motivation because they have all these recovery role models there? So lots of interesting questions. And then like I mentioned before, I'm really interested in how we can use these sites to help enhance treatment and recovery outcomes for young adults. Not necessarily because I think young adults are the only people that could benefit, but because traditionally young people have been really challenging for the field, and it's something I'm really interested in trying to do something about in my research and clinical work. So before I get to the third study and some of the conclusions, that's a good point to pause. Any questions about this second study about intherooms.com and the survey I did on its membership or on its participants?
Hi, this I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm wondering if there were other live meetings offered besides the 12-step program meetings and the smart recovery ones.
On intherooms.com?
Yes.
Yeah. So they have like 120 live online meetings right now. It's really cool. It takes place at all times of the day. And yes, is the answer to your question. They have like a women in recovery meeting, which is more about a broader perspective on the recovery process. And really the idea is to cater to women and give women a chance to share experience with the women. There's a veterans in recovery meeting I know off the top of my head. There are others that I'm forgetting. But yes, and then there's also there's other kinds of quote-unquote behavioral or process addictions, but far fewer. So there's one, Gamblers Anonymous meeting. There's one for folks that are struggling with different kinds of addiction to food or overeating. Sex and love addiction. So, but again, those meetings are far less frequent. They're way more like AA meetings and NA meetings, but those are present, yes.
Thank you.
Sure, yeah. One point I forgot to mention around those live online meetings there is that you can participate with a webcam, right? Like you can be on there in a video capacity, share, have other people see you, interact with people in more of a video chat kind of way. Or you can just go on and watch and listen and observe where it shows that you're like in the meeting because at the very bottom, and you'll see on that slide, it shows that that you're there. But like if you're anonymous and you don't have your picture as part of your profile, you could just essentially observe and get a feel for what the meetings are like without necessarily having to identify yourself, which I know some people find helpful, especially at the beginning if they're a bit anxious.
Mm-hmm.
other questions? Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. What is In the Rooms? Who runs it? Is it a for-profit, non-profit?
So yes, it's a for-profit organization. It was started by two guys in long-term recovery, Ken Pomerantz and R.T. Tannenbaum. You can look on the site and it'll go into all that. They're the CEO and COO. And so they started that. Part of their model is an advertising model. And so in the rooms, it's one of the things that I think is important for the field to try to not get a handle on, but think about what the best model is. So there are other sites, for example, like Sober Grid is another recovery-specific social network site that, and if you look at my disclosures, you'll see I just signed on as an advisory board member to Sober Grid. I don't have a financial stake in it, though. And I do some consulting work for them as well. So they've got some NIH grant funding, but they're small business grants, so they're trying to figure out what the best business model is to help support people in recovery, and they're taking a bit more of a data-driven approach to try to understand how people participate, what are the best ways we can tinker with these sites to engage people. And so depending on this, each site is going to have its own idiosyncrasies. And certainly, if you go on In the Rooms, you'll see one of the idiosyncrasies is that it uses it has ads for like treatment centers and things like that.
Okay.
Yeah, the last thing I'll mention is there are sites that are what I would consider to be recovery specific sites, but they're not standalone sites. So that is, they are embedded within existing general interest sites. So a good example that's gotten some play in the press is called Stop Drinking. That's the name of it. And it's on a social network site called Reddit, which is somewhat popular among certain groups, but not everybody knows about it. I'm not getting into too much about what Reddit is. The site itself, it looks and reads and feels very much like a discussion board, but it is more of a community. It has a very specific culture within it. It's got some you can get like don't have time to get too much into it. But that site is not for profit and it's completely grassroots and nobody really, just the moderators or the monitors are folks in recovery themselves that are participants. And there's nobody that's profiting from it. There's no economic or business model. It's just a site that grew naturalistically or in a grassroots fashion on Reddit for individuals that wanted to stop drinking or in recovery from alcohol problems and wanted the community to do so. And right now, if you go on the site, it says that there are like 120,000 users. That doesn't mean they're all active. At any given time, there are probably like 200, 300, 400 people that are active. And each site has sort of its own, again, culture. Like, again, in the rooms, you can engage in a real-time sort of way, chatting with people in a live online video meeting, sort of same thing on SoberGrid, but like Stop Drinking on Reddit, for example, it's all asynchronous in terms of the timing. So you post, and then you wait for people to post back. It's not necessarily in real time.
Can you spell Reddit, please?
R-E-D-D-I-T, yeah. And so, and the terminology you'll sometimes hear people use, so Reddit is the name of the site, and the different discussion boards or online communities within Reddit are often called subreddits, like sub-zero temperatures, but subreddits. One of the things you might do if you're interested in the Reddit site is Google Stop Drinking Reddit Washington Post, because the Washington Post wrote a story on it. And that can kind of give you more information. It was written, a year or two ago, so the numbers might not be up to date, but that'll give you a bit more sense of what goes on there. I'm gonna run really quick through the third study because we only got about 10 minutes left. The third study, if you just look at the questions, I'm not gonna give you guys a sense of what's led them on, so I'm just going to run through them, so kind of just follow along with me. So for this third study, I looked at young adults, 18 to 25-year-olds, that were presenting for an evaluation of their substance use in the outpatient addiction treatment program here at Mass General, where I used to be a staff psychologist. As part of their evaluation, they got all sorts of questionnaires that they do, that they completed. I got IRB approval to add a questionnaire around their social network site use. And are they being exposed to alcohol or their drug content when they participate on social network sites? Are they using any of these recovery social network sites I mentioned? And then if they are being exposed to alcohol or drug content on social network sites, is that affecting their psychological psychological recovery related processes in some way? Are they experiencing increased craving, et cetera? And on the flip side, I was interested if they're using social network sites to help them, either to kind of aid their recovery or to help enhance health, their health behaviors in other ways, are they experiencing an increased motivation for recovery because of that? So that was really the crux here. And if you look at the slides, one of the things you'll notice is that the sample size was pretty small, so these data are not published, and I probably won't look to publish them. But they are interesting and give some inkling about this population. So the sample size was, I think, 51, and that was about a 50% response rate. So 50% of the people that showed up for evaluations that could have done the survey didn't do the survey. So it's important to kind of qualify all these findings within those limitations. All that being said, virtually all of them, 96% of them, were using a social network site in the last month. More than half, so like 60%, were doing so daily or multiple times per day. And about 60% of them were active on these social network sites an hour a day. When I say active, I mean they were posting or reading, not just having it open. And the graph on slide 34 shows the sites that they were using. Facebook, most popular, Instagram comes right after that, as you see. The only important thing to note here is that none of them, not one of them, had ever used a recovery social network site. So what that tells me is, at least among young people that are showing up to outpatient treatment, this study was done a little bit ago, if we're going to get them to use recovery sites, which I want them to so that I can measure and study whether that's actually helpful, there's going to need to be some sort of facilitation or active linkage to that. And so What we saw was that there was quite a bit of exposure to alcohol and the drug content. 85% said yes, I had at least some exposure to alcohol to drug content, even though I wasn't necessarily seeking it out. So passive exposure. Less commonly, they were using social network sites to enhance their recovery or other health outcomes. But for the minority that were using social network sites for that purpose, they did experience an increased motivation for abstinence. On the flip side, though, if they were exposed to alcohol and drug content, only 60% didn't experience any kind of increased craving. I think the important thing to mention there is these were folks that hadn't been through any treatment. They might have been through treatment in the past, but it was just the very beginning of their treatment experience. Some of them may not have been engaging with treatment at all. It was just an initial evaluation. So they might not have been aware of what a craving feels like or whatever, or they might have been and just didn't experience any. I'm going to skip to the sort of recap of the three studies and then talk about some questions that have come for me in the context of this work and my future directions, and hopefully we'll have 2, 3, 4 minutes for any questions at the end. So to recap the three studies, 1 in 10 U.S. adults who have resolved the problem use online technologies as part of that effort. When we look at those who are participating on a recovery-specific social network site like In the Rooms, they tend to perceive it as helpful, and that it does seem to be that those with less than a year or not abstinent at all, they perceive it or regard it as just as helpful as those with a year or more. So it can be potentially a service or a resource that might be useful, that's important to test for those who are in treatment or trying to make a change in their substance use. And lastly, emerging adults that have substance disorder or presumably have substance disorder, they're attending an outpatient evaluation. They all were diagnosed with substance disorder, by the way, by the clinician who evaluated them. We did a chart review. Like their general population young adult counterparts, they're participating on social network sites at higher rates and are likely to explore passive exposure to substance-related content on these platforms. So on questions on slides 38, and I'm going to skip, I included some information about a proposed research design that have a grant or almost have a grant, knock on wood, and I'll really be studying this stuff in more detail and getting a longitudinal look in terms of a clinical sample and trying to get a sense of empirically, does a social network site, recovery social network site participation make a difference over and above treatment, over and above other kinds of recovery support service utilization, and if it does make a difference, if so, how? Is it in some of the ways that I think, which is by helping expand their network support for recovery? But here are just some questions that are important for me and that I want to ask now. Is, like I said, does greater participation confer added benefit? And then is there more benefit or less benefit for certain subgroups? Can it substitute for traditional services? Or maybe it's a conduit to face-to-face. So maybe if you have young adults that are showing up to treatment, but they're hesitant or reluctant to go to 12-step or other mutual help meetings, there are lots of different reasons why that might be. These online services could be a way to kind of, quote, unquote, dip their toe in the water and say, oh, this doesn't feel too bad, and I also see other people in the water who look like they're kind of having a good time, and maybe I'm willing to go to mutual help meetings. And maybe the online services are enough to help kind of confer benefit. And then the third question is the field has been working really hard, and lots of research was done well before I ever came into the field, of which I'm trying to build on the seminal work in the area for how social processes are being measured in recovery and how do they affect outcome, what's going on online. And then the last slide looks at some questions for later. And this, I'm going to skip to the last slide because we were talking about some of these privacy issues, and this is really important. This is starting to come up, and it was coming up before, is you have people that are talking about sensitive stuff on these recovery sites. They're talking about their substance use and their well-being, and some of them are talking about potentially things they did criminally, right? And so all these issues are important to start to think about, and how data is being used or not used and these things. And then the last piece that really is not part of the discussion or hasn't been for the most part to this point is there's a whole literature that's developing orthogonally, right? So it's not – these two literatures are developing in parallel but separate from each other on, quote-unquote, internet or smartphone addiction. So we think about those as substance use problems. A reasonable hypothesis is that they're also going to be vulnerable. They're also going to be vulnerable to the effects of becoming having problematic internet use or problematic smartphone use. And so that's an important question for me that I think will be important. That I want to start to take a look at as things go on. So I'll stop there. I know I ran through those slides and we're about out of time. But are there any kind of final questions? I'm happy to stay on in a minute or two after 2 o'clock if anybody has questions.
Yeah, I mean, my only question is not so much a question as an observation that I think the real challenge will be in seeing how this kind of participation translates into recovery rates. And
I
don't know how you're going to do that. It seems like a real challenge, but hey,
what I'll say is the only thing I could say there is two things. One, yes, you're right, it is a challenge. But two, research in mutual health organizations was always considered a challenge, right? These community-based participation and how that impacts recovery rates over time. And so there are ways in which I can build off some of the work that's been done in that area to help adapt that and use that to inform work on some of these online recovery communities. And at the same time, it's a bit easier in some ways than trying to get a sense of mutual health participation, for example, because to the extent that people will allow us to, we can actually get a sense of how long they're spending on the site and what they're doing, how much they're interacting with each other. Are they deriving some sense of social support? And ask them about that. But that's, I have a grant, or again, almost knock on wood, to study this very question, where we're going to be taking people, young adults that are in treatment, and linking half of them to these recovery sites and the other half not, and getting a sense of what are they doing, how are they using it, and then actually looking empirically, analytically, at whether that participation is associated prospectively over time with better outcomes or not, and then if so, how is that occurring?
It sounds awesome. Listen, I don't know if there are any other questions, but I want to thank you. It was a wonderful presentation. I really, it held my attention all the way through. And,
oh, good.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. And I know that I kind of bumped up against the end of the hour here without giving people too much of a chance to ask questions. So I'm happy to send you some of the PDFs of the studies that I mentioned. Also, if folks have other questions, they're certainly more than I'm certainly more than willing to schedule calls with people after the fact or exchange emails with people, because I'm happy to talk about this stuff offline as well.
Yeah, I have about a dozen questions, which I won't pose.
Good. No, we'll talk more. I'd love to get your thoughts, certainly.
Yeah, you know, if you want to send PDFs to me, people could use me as the contact point. Which, you know, might be easier than everybody contacting you, but they, you know, they may
sure.
want to contact you.
Definitely. That's I'm happy to do that.
I just want to thank you. There was so much useful information, and you got
good.
Seemingly unwrapped.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Glad you found it helpful.
Let me make one last quick announcement. Like I said, May, it's a little up in the air as to a presenter. In June, we're having Fred Rogers present on why addiction is not a disease, which should be really interesting. And we're going to have something on drug courts coming up a little later on. But I want to thank everybody for participating and spread the word. And thanks again to Brandon Bergman for presenting today.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and that's it.